My name is Debbie and I'm an alcoholic. Our faith tradition states that our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Valley Groups honor this tradition by rigorously searching for the finest recovery speakers in the Western Hemisphere so that they can share their experience, strength, and hope with us. Each week, we recognize one of these speakers for the service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is now time to recognize Valley Group's Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of 2-6-1988. She has been involved in conferences and was part of a sobriety committee for an Indian reservation. Sobriety community. When I asked her what her favorite AA motto is, she said, first things first. So without any further ado, may I have the envelope, please? We're waiting for this all day.
The envelope?
Nope. You. We're waiting for you all day. The winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week Award is Leslie from Fresno.
Oh, what's this? Oh, my God. That's beautiful. Speaker of the Week. Okay. Cool. Okay. Oh, yeah. And you wouldn't know it if I didn't. My name is Leslie, and I'm an alcoholic. It's real good to be here. I'm going to shift this up just a little bit. Just up a little. So I don't, like, hit it with my... Yeah, that's cool. All right. So I got sober in St. Louis at the Lindell Club 7 a.m. meeting, where I attended 5-6 meetings a week for about 10 years. I got, after that, my home group kind of was on the road, whatever I could get in the small Indian reservations, and until I came to Fresno. I had some tours in maybe one town that had a lot of meetings, but Fresno, I got to Fresno about 4 months ago, and I have two home groups, and one home group is the I Can't, We Can't Thursday night women's group, and they call themselves the Treasures, and there's a lot of other meetings that are attached to them, but I haven't done those, so I go to the Thursday night meeting at it's at 7:30 on North Fresno, in case you want to come join us. As you can see, they're very supportive. It's one of the best women's meetings I've ever been to, and I think God brought me here for a lot of different reasons, and this would be them. So can you just, you know, yell, you guys? Okay. All right. My other home group is on, you go to a home group with your sponsor. My other home group is a Sunday morning Fresno Fellowship, and I see one member here at least at 9 o'clock in the morning because my sponsor goes there, and she needs to see me. I need to see her and, you know, get to know each other and make sure we're on the right path, okay? So I have a responsibility to AA to... tell my story, experience, strength, and hope, and tell you what it was like and what things are like now. I'm a little bit dramatic, so I'll try to keep it down. first of all, do you guys know how Bill gets his speakers? No, this is kind of funny because we were at an event in Fresno, and I have been in these small places for a really long time, and nobody's asked me out on a date in a long time. So here's this guy that's talking to me, and he says, "Can I ask you a question?" And then he just pauses, okay? And I'm going, "Oh my God, he's gonna," in my head, okay? This is alcoholic, okay? In my head, I'm going, "Oh my God, he's going to ask me on a date. What do I say? What do I do?" And then he asked me to come speak at the meeting, okay? So, that's the first part of the thing here. So that was pretty funny. So I yeah, so we're in St. Louis, and I grew up in St. Louis. It's the murder capital of the world, if you didn't know that, for most of my life and most of my grown-up life. It's kind of a place where you either learn how to protect yourself in some way or you fall and you get beat up and whatever. I was born to two alcoholic parents, I guess they didn't get to drinking a whole lot in the beginning part of my life, but they did, about 10 or 11, they started drinking a whole lot. There's something, just part of my story, it's not as fun to talk about, but I wasn't able to say it in public for most of my recovery until a few years ago. But we experienced a violent crime when I was 3 years old. So at that time, all three of us, it was just us, I didn't have any brothers and sisters, we dealt with it our own way. We all shut down, acted out, whatever it was that we needed to do to deal with that. I didn't drink because of that. I drank because I picked up that first drink. But it's definitely part of my story and part of my recovery too. So we moved around a lot, as well as I moved around in my recovery and in my life. But we moved around a lot, and we lived in this one kind of neighborhood where I had to get back and forth to school for you know, in ways that, in, like, this was a tough town, but I was kind of sheltered in my home, so I wasn't quite that, I didn't turn tough yet. There were some things that happened on the street, stuff happened on the street, where it was really convenient for me to say, that's not ever going to happen to me again. Fuck these people. I'm going to change my personality. I'm going to keep everybody away. So I did, and it worked. And I became tough, and if you got too close to me, I was fighting people all the time, and we moved out of that neighborhood, and I continued this, I was about 11, and I continued this hardcore, tough gal that nobody could get close to. I mean, you know, and I didn't want them anywhere near me anyway. I had my first drink when I was 12, so that helped me continue my identity. I'm a tough-ass girl, you know, this bad girl. Helped me make that transition, I guess. It got rid of the fear. It got rid of the inhibition in terms of having friends. And I had a purpose. and it was, you know, drinking and doing drugs and, you know, that sort of thing. The people in my life, they all drank and all did drugs, or they were just coming out of jail or going to jail. I skipped school. We had parties at the house, you know, and every different kind of drug and every different kind of alcohol, and that was while I was in school. Got kicked out of high school because of the alcohol and drugs. Got taken to jail more than once as a teenager. The boys started to come into my life, I used that as a way to get some kind of feeling of love in my life. I felt like that was love. And so I pursued, got a lot of guys, doing tornadoes through guys' lives, actually. You know, I didn't really have them around all that long. I was pretty much of a drama gal. I remember the guys back then, and I don't know what you guys call them now, but Psycho Bitch, one of those? Yes, so I was one of those. Yeah. So, our drama queen, and I'm going to have to tell on you guys just a little bit here, because there's a lot of guys in this room that like drama, women, okay? A lot of you do. I know, because it was easier for me to pick up a guy with my drama queen than it was, you know, than it was without. So I know that you guys like it, all right? So, I think that part of my disease for me was being addicted to crisis and to drama itself. So it didn't take much for me to have my life totally fall apart in every way, not have a place to live, not have any money, not have any friends or family, and then put it all back together in that same speed. You know, I was able to tear it all. It came all the way down, and then I would build it all up, and I just kind of went like that. That was my life. It was down and then up and down and up. So in my relationships, I want to talk about that a little bit because it reminds me of how my relationships were. I didn't want to be around too long because by 6 months, I would have had an anger outburst, and I would have either hit a family member of yours, pulled a gun on you, or a family member, and so I didn't really want to hang around too long because anger would just build up, and I had this urge to just fight, okay? So sometimes I did that in bars. Sometimes I would be the one to start the barroom brawl because I liked excitement. So bam, okay, do it with me. And if I could get somebody to do the drama with me, then I did that. I knew what types of alcohol to drink to be so exciting to start a fight. So that as a Tanqueray gin really made me fight. So I would drink that just to fight. Pretty early into my drinking, I was chronic. You know, and what I mean by that is that I couldn't get through the day without some kind of substance in my system to function. I was an IV drug user, and I say that not to be disrespectful, but to tell you that as part of my story. So I started doing IV drug use at 15 years old, and not because I set out in my life to do that. It was just I was in the right place at the wrong time or the wrong place in the right time, whatever happened at that moment. And I liked it because it was dramatic, you know, it was, you know. So it got me into these places that were really, really drama filled and drug houses that I couldn't get out of and places that I couldn't get out of and feelings that I, you know, I just couldn't, you know, I was just in this thing and just out of control, totally out of control, not feeling like I had any choice whatsoever in the deal, because when, you know, I looked around and I said, you know, this is my life. This is how it is. This is how I am. I kind of thought that other people acted like me, so it took a while before I could see that other folks, you know, were having a somewhat normal life, or they could drink normally, or do drugs normally, or whatever. Every once in a while during this time, I would get on, I thought you were giving me a little sign to be honest or something. This is the sign, to be honest, okay? Bring your home group to the meeting, okay? So, where was I? What was I doing? Where was I? Honesty? Be honest, I forgot. I don't even know where it was. Oh, yeah, you know, the drug house, yeah, I can go right back there. The excitement of that, but again, even in those situations, I really didn't let anybody pretty near me too much, you know. I pretty much kept everybody at a distance and tried to keep myself safe. That was the way to keep myself safe. When I really was trying to keep myself safe, I went into that fight mode and got myself in trouble. Being cars with ex-cons and lie to the police and just anything that was dramatic. My jobs, I have to tell this one because I just remembered it the other day. You know, it's convenient, I think. It was convenient for me because I've been working and living in Indian communities for the last 15 years. And in those small communities, sometimes there's only one group, and you're not going to, you know, some of them were my clients. And so I didn't want to tell them all the garbage because maybe they wouldn't come to see me. But I didn't talk about it all the time unless I got some meetings out of town. But I'm here with this home group here, and boy, these gals get down, I'm telling you. So I'm remembering all this shit, this funny stuff. I mean, just stuff I haven't thought of in years. So I was talking to this one gal in the meeting, and she was actually at my house. Where are you, Eileen? Yeah, I was thinking about my job before I came into the program. And one time I was a prostitute at a massage parlor, and I got fired. So I fell asleep on the guy. So you really can't do that. Okay, you really can't do that. So while I was working at that massage parlor, I had. That's good, isn't it? Yeah, I like it. I like it too. It's kind of funny. Oh my God. in my spare time at that massage parlor, you know, when we didn't have clients and stuff, I figured out how to rob the place, and I called my friend to tell him how to rob it. You know, I knew exactly where they were putting the money. I knew how to get him in the back door. He never robbed it, but I had this great plan. My friends, those kinds of friends really liked me because I was creative with how to get something done. Sometimes I wish this was bullshit, but it actually is true. Another activity that I'm actually qualifying myself for that bad girl role, because in some ways I liked that bad girl role, because that, again, that kept me away from you. I didn't have to get close to you. I didn't have to feel you leave me. I didn't have to feel you not like me, and everything that comes along with that. So when in the beginning of coming to meetings and starting to speak at meetings, my sponsors would tell me, my first couple of sponsors would tell me that I could not talk about my bad girl days, because I love talking about my bad girl days, you know, because that keeps me such a distance from you, you know, it does, because then I can say how bad I am and how, and that just keeps me, but underneath, I've always been pretty scared of everybody. You know, when I was a kid, growing up in St. Louis, I was scared of everybody on the street. I had this dream in recovery, but it kind of gives you a good idea how I felt. I had a dream that, that my parents were monsters, and that I stole food and went underneath the house to live, and then out in the street all the kids had machetes. So, you know, it was just a representation of how afraid I was of everybody. Let's fast forward a little bit and how I got closer to getting into the program, because I got a lot of recovery stuff to talk about. In that life, I wasn't, I was managing to make a buck because I was hustling buck. I never had a real job where you clocked in. I hustled a buck either in the massage parlor or selling stuff on the street, making jewelry. I did that for a while. That was kind of cool. One time I had a shoe shine business. If I wasn't selling drugs or living with a dealer and helping him or whatever like that, but I was just always hustling a buck. So right there at the end there, I got a job selling advertising. I got to tell you the story right before that. Wait a minute. I got to go back a second. So I'm right there deciding, trying to figure out how to stop. My life was crazy. My life was absolutely crazy. I had gotten a car and paid a down payment from somebody, but I didn't remember who they were. I had the car. I called home to my parents and said, hey, I want to come back to St. Louis. I was in Texas. I had been living on the beach. I had been selling artwork and doing anything for a dollar, and I had this car. I left town with that car and made my way back home, and so I had a stolen car, actually. I didn't know who I got it from. It had Texas plates on it, but right when I got back to St. Louis, I got a job selling advertising, and it was a real job. I thought it was a real job. So I go to work, and this was about 4 months before I got clean and sober. I was still doing drugs every day, alcohol every day. Sometimes I looked good and sometimes I didn't, you know, and I didn't really care about if I took a bath or not, or, unless there was something I was going to get out of it. At that point, I didn't go out with a guy unless he had something I was going to get. I was going to get some drugs that night. I was going to get a place to sleep that night. I was going to maybe get some money out of their pocketbook, something. You know, I wasn't even hanging out with anybody unless I could get something. So, I was tired of, the lifestyle, but I didn't know how, I didn't think I had any choices or anything, but I had this job, and I thought, oh my gosh, I have a job, I have a normal job, so now I can straighten up. And this was about 4 months before, and I just tried to get, tried to get my shit together, but I was still ending up at the drug house, and I was still, I found my old friends I grew up with, and they were all junkies, so I said, oh boy, this is great, I hit the jackpot there. I really, really had this desire to, succeed in my life. I wanted to do something better for myself. I wanted to, be somebody and do something, but I was just taking myself, down with the drugs, and I didn't know how to stop. And I don't know that I thought I had to stop, but I didn't know how to stop. So I got on a binge of OD'ing, trying to stop for a day or two, doing too much, ending up in the hospital. One of the last times I OD'd, the drug dealer in the house gave me CPR. He wouldn't give me any more drugs, and he gave me a big book. Okay? Yeah, the drug dealer. Yeah, it's kind of funny. So, in this scenario, I have a stolen car. I have a big book. I can't stay half alive. Now I remember about the crisis. So some of the, almost dying thing was a lot of drama that I, kind of got off on. So, but I think there was a part of me that wanted to live, I wanted to live. I didn't want to die. So, when it really came down, I was in a halfway house in the north side of town of St. Louis. I don't know if anybody has ever seen St. Louis, but the north side of town of St. Louis. I was only one of my race in the halfway house. They could smell the alcohol in the hallway. People were crawling into my bed. I had called the 1-800 health line because my best friend and my mother found me in the drug house and talked me out of the house. And then I called the 1-800 line and got into this place. They wouldn't keep me right away because they thought I was physically going to die. So we had to, I had to go to the emergency room. And in that emergency room, the gal said, we're going to have to amputate her arm. And I believed her, and I still don't know if she was telling the truth or not, but I believed her. I really did. So I went back to the halfway house. I tried to stay clean and sober at that, or tried to do something. I was 10 days clean in that place, and that was... it must have been January, 25 years ago. And my parents came to town, and this is an important piece for families of alcoholism. And I'm going to tear up because, you know, if my mom had not said, no more, Leslie, no more. I'm not doing it anymore. I can't come and watch you kill yourself. I can't bail you out. I can't pay your rent. I can't help you out of the jam you're in anymore. I can't do it. And so she left me in this halfway house. It was like I didn't even feel like I was even safe physically, much less, you know, what a recovery place. So, I mean, talk about treatment. You know, you guys probably had it lucky if you went to a nice treatment center. But this place, I think, taught me, you know, it taught me that I didn't want to stay out there. So Mom did the hardest thing she ever had to do in her whole life, and I'm so, so grateful for that. She left. I knew she was gone. I knew she was gone out of my life. And I'm really, really proud of her because today is her 23 AA birthday. She came into recovery right after me and sort of about 24-hour period around my second year birthday, and she's sober too. But so you know, I'm still at the halfway house trying to figure it out. My boss says he'll give me my job back. I get out of the halfway house, OD again. And then made it to this job 3 days after I said I was going to be there. Hadn't had a bath. Had my clothes on where, you know, my buttons weren't even straight. And owner of the advertising company asked me what I wanted to do. And I said I want to go back to the drug house. And so he let me walk out the door. I went out to the car. The car wouldn't start. God, the car wouldn't start, you know, and the guy came out, asked me for my keys, I gave him the keys, and we were on our road, we were on the road. So, we had to leave town because of this, this work thing, and I had this big old fever blister on my face, and, you know, just not, and they brought me some clothes to kind of help me clean up so I could work. Nobody would let me out of their sight because they thought I would go again. So, I was, on a business trip trying to sell this advertising. Can't do it sober, by the way. I'm not as good as Bill. Bill's a really good salesman. I have a stolen car, you know, too, on top of it. I just looked a mess, you know, I looked a mess. But I have that big book too. So I'm reading the big book, I'm in the hotel room, and it gets to that part, you know, if you're kind of wondering, if you're an alcoholic, go down to the bar and drink two drinks. So I did. So I went down and I couldn't drink two drinks. And this was the moment. This was the moment. You know, it all sort of came together. And there's a movie that was playing. I can't find it anywhere. So if you guys find the movie, please track me down. Life of the Party, Carol Burnett was trying to kill her husband with a knife, and she went to her first AA meeting after getting sober, and for some reason that all kicked in and I decided to get sober. I think I left one thing out with my husband, or this would have made more sense. Yeah, I really kind of need to go back there a little bit. So if you remember, if you guys, how many of you are married or have been married, guys, guys been married, or girls too, actually. But you know when the wife comes in and she wants to talk? You know that? You know, hey, I want to talk. So I came home one night, I want to talk. My husband was 6'5", okay, big old hands, an iron worker. And he said, I said, I want to talk. He didn't want to talk. I pulled the shotgun out and cocked it back. Now you want to talk, you motherfucker? And so he stood straight up in the bed, okay? So anyway, so that this little story with Carol Burnett makes a little more sense, okay? Oh, shoot. I found recovery by, I didn't want to go to treatment because it would have been the halfway house. And I didn't want to, you know, learn how to stay out of jail. I actually wanted to get sober at this point. I didn't know how to be sober. I was, you know, pretty ragged out. I didn't know how to live. I felt like when I first, you know, when I got to a point where I wanted to find myself, you know, who am I? Who am I? I think that my thoughts were, where I was I was either rebelling from my parents or wanting approval from my parents. I was existing like this, and I had never stopped to ask myself who I was, because this is how I was acting. And so I came into the program. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, like they told me. I never did anything that anyone ever told me, ever. When I was a teenager, I took control of the house, you know, and I would try to beat up my father and whatever. I took control of the house. So I never, ever, but I wanted to stay sober, so I went to 90 meetings, 90 days. I picked my sponsor because she had a fur coat and she was a prostitute, and I thought that we could relate, and she actually was a really, really good sponsor. I was scared to death. You know, I was scared to death because I didn't have as much of my tough girl on the outside. I was trying to find, you know, I just didn't have that as much anymore, so I was scared to death. When I was about a year and a half sober, I had a boyfriend. I didn't follow directions from the sponsor all that well. But I did go to my 90 days and 90 meetings, but I did get a relationship pretty quick. It's almost, I look back and I think that it kind of stabilized me a little bit, because I was a wild girl, you know. I was off and running, and I carved my initials in a table meeting in the beginning, and, you know, I wasn't one of the ones that you thought, oh gosh, you know, she's going to make it. I was just quite the opposite. So 30 days into the program, I had a car accident, and I had a stolen car, so the cops came over to they were trying to pry me out of the car, and they asked me what my name was, and I lied and said I lived in California, and I got by with that, later on having to do amends, but I didn't know who to make it to, so I had to do some other kinds of amends. A year and a half into the program, you know, I was trying to build a foundation in AA and NA and ACCUPA and any meeting I could go to. And, you know, you do what you got to do. I'm a believer in that I could not stay clean and sober unless I was willing to do anything to do that, you know. And I didn't know the way, but I was still willing to do anything it took to stay sober. About a year and a half in the program, I beat up my boyfriend, so I still had a lot of anger. And he took me to therapy with him. Okay? So I met a gal who helped change my life. God, of course, worked through her. Her name is Sharon, and you guys can call her in St. Louis if you need her. But she was, I knew when I found her that she was tough enough to get through that anger with me. I was afraid to leave her because I knew that she could help, and I was, you know, I could walk over everybody, you know. Everybody wanted to take care of me. I could get anything out of anybody. So, I mean, I was just like, you know, I knew she would help me. So, in recovery, I had a therapist, and she was in the, had been in the program, you know, she's in the program too. She kind of acted like a sponsor too, and she started to knock through that wall that I had built around me to protect myself. And, you know, I don't feel like that, I had that first few years I was miserable, you know, I was. I didn't have many happy days at all. I was fighting myself so hard. I was fighting. Had I not found her when I did, and, you know, there's a reason that that I did, that I would not have made it, okay? So she had persistence, I think, because I told her off and everybody in the place, but she had some persistence with me, saw something in me that I did not see. I allowed myself to love for the first time because, you know, I felt like somebody heard me. I felt I could trust somebody, and she helped me, you know, change. I don't think that I got through the third step to the third step until then. You know, I went through it with my sponsor, but I didn't let go of anything. I couldn't let go of that control. I couldn't let go of keeping everybody away from me. I went to meetings. They all said, love you all at the end. I don't love you. How can I say I love you? I don't love myself, you know? So I just kept, going forward with Sharon, and she taught me those things. The spirituality to me of the program, there is not just a spiritual part of the program, okay? Everything is spiritual. Me meeting Sharon was spiritual. Me coming tonight is a spiritual thing. Me meeting my group here and everything that happens in my life is spiritual. There's not a spiritual part of it. And I've tried every different kind of religion in recovery, including like rebirthing and New Age, homeopathic breath work, and the Buddhist community. I'm not making fun. I'm just saying I tried it all. And you know, I took some pieces from everybody and everything. And when it all comes down to it, there is nothing like AA, okay? It's simple, you know, it's simple. There's nothing like AA. None of that, I mean, you know, the path I traveled is a path that I took. It's been bumpy, but I think once the anger left and I hung around long enough for that miracle to happen, every day has been relatively happy for me. I've gotten to do lots more than I ever thought I was able to do. To be busy, I went back to school and I'm working on my third degree, and kind of gave my life to the communities in Indian country that I worked for, and I really loved it a lot. At first it was about me, and then I realized it was God's work, because you know what? You can't think about yourself when you're in Indian country. I don't know if anybody's been there, but you cannot think about yourself. And I had to think about other people, so I came out on the other side a much better person, and I'm real happy about that. So I think that that's pretty much the story. I've got a lot of funny stories to tell, but that's about all we have time for tonight. And I really appreciate being invited here. Thank you very much.